Hello, everybody, and welcome to Paddock Project. I'm your host, Tiggy, and I have a very special guest with me here today, Kurt Badenhausen. Kurt is the leader in sports valuations, has been doing that work for decades, led the charge at Forbes, and is now at Sportico, where Kurt, you just published F1 valuations, which was really fun for me and for, I think, a lot of F1 fans to dig into. And as I was saying before we hit record, not to embarrass you, Kurt, but the sports business management class I'm taking in school right now, the very first day, our professor said your name. And I was like, this is worlds colliding. I have to absolutely talk to Kurt. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, no, your professor is one of the OGs in this space. He's been teaching it for a long time, long before every university seemed to pop up with a sports management program. He's been leading the charge. So yes. Happy to join.
It's all the rage. So let's start. What made you choose sports as an asset that you wanted to value? Like, what makes sports so unique from a business perspective in your eyes?
Yeah, this goes back. I was just out of college. I joined a place called Financial World. My longtime partner in crime, Mike Ozanian, was there, and he had come up with this idea of valuing sports teams. And people thought it was crazy. Not crazy. They didn't understand what it even meant. Because this is 30 years ago, they thought they'd ask, you know, you're talking about what the players are worth, or, you know, I don't get it. Like, no, you know, if a team was to be bought or sold, that what somebody would pay for it. Again, this is 30 something years ago. It wasn't an asset class. And people are like, who would ever care about something like that? I don't get it. But a couple, you know, one of the big things that had just happened, Jerry Jones had recently bought the Dallas Cowboys, spent a lot of money on it, kind of opened people's eyes a little bit. But even back then, investment bankers didn't really think about it so much because they didn't see quite the value from a M&A standpoint in representing these owners. Their primary concern back in the 1990s was financing for all the stadium construction going on. They saw that's where the money was, lending teams the money to build new buildings, because incredible growth that happened through the 1990s in particular in terms of stadium and arena building. As the valuations started to increase and these banks' clients started to be more interested in buying sports teams, the bigger banks started to get into it and think about it from an M&A standpoint. And then kind of the big banks stepped away a little bit. A lot of those bankers left, started boutique firms on their own, which and represent a lot of the deals that go on in the place. But now we've seen a reorganization and a formalization of some of the bigger banks like JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, who have done sports but are kind of formalizing their sports practices. So at Forbes, we did it. Joined Forbes, 1998 was the first year we published valuations at Forbes, Mike and I, and then worked together to do it for what back then was four major sports leagues, eventually MLS, global soccer, started doing NASCAR, and we did F1 valuations, which got a lot of attention when we first did it. It was a much different time for F1. You had a few big dogs who were spending all the money and bringing in all the money, and a bunch of teams that were kind of struggling to hold on. And so I joined Sportico in 2021 and head up the sports valuations we do there. And F1 was one of those that I was so excited to do because so much had changed. Forbes hadn't done it for a few years, and it was great to kind of dig in and say, whoa, this whole series has changed dramatically since we last looked at it at Forbes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much has changed. I guess for those listening, some context, if you're not aware, Liberty Media, which now owns Formula One, acquired F1 in 2017 for, I think, only about $4.4 billion. It's now worth over $20 billion. So, Kurt, let's talk about that growth. Like, as we saw in your recent Sportico valuations for F1, every single F1 team is now worth over $1 billion. What do you kind of attribute that growth to?
Yeah, I saw somebody's sports media predictions for 2025, and they predicted every F1 team would be worth $1 billion. They clearly are not reading Sportico, because as far as we're concerned,
shame on them.
Every franchise, every team is worth $1 billion at this point. Most recently, when we published our last valuations, the average $2.3 billion, up 44% from the valuations that we published. We didn't quite do it 12 months later. It was about 17 months later. And so a couple things have really happened. It's not all Drive to Survive, but that is a component, not to be ignored. But it is not the overarching reason for suddenly these teams being worth so much money. You need to give Liberty a lot of credit for their leadership and how they've steered this sport. And F1, for all the fans out there, I mean, it's forever been this kind of elitist sport that would race in Monaco and all these, you know, really cater to that high-end audience and kind of ignore the general audience in many ways, or wasn't necessarily concerned with monetizing that audience. And it was all about race day and you know, the fans, the paddock club, and just really that high-end clientele. And you know, Bernie Ecclestone ran the series forever, would really kind of thumb his nose at the, you know, so-called commoners. What Liberty Media has done is a couple of things. One, they've managed to maintain this premium brand, make it a premium asset, but also turn it into something that is more digestible for a larger audience. Mm. And also, in particular, an American audience. Part of that is Drive to Survive, which obviously took off and created a ton of new fans. And then also the function of moving from one race, we had one race in Austin in the U.S. for a very long time, moving to three races, and those two races in Miami and Las Vegas both just absolutely took off. Vegas race, of course, is very different because Liberty also owns the race. So if you think about changes on the race calendar, Vegas isn't going anywhere because Liberty owns that one. So, and they invested a lot of money to create the infrastructure to hold races there. So that was a big part of what's happened. And they've turned race weekends into so much more than just what happens on the track on Sundays. You know, you have multi days of qualifying and racing, but it's just all of the programming that goes around racing right now. I mean, in Austin with concerts and big mm-hmm. names showing up and performing. And so you've got people coming. So it's not just, I want to come and be on there on Sunday. I want to come for 4 days and I'm going to spend money on all these different things that revolve around the race. I mean, in Miami, the race was like secondary third on the list of just all the stuff that was going on in Miami. And I'm probably saving the biggest for last, really, because it deserves a little more time, is putting in cost controls was a total game changer in terms of how these assets are looked at from a business standpoint. Because for so long, the top of the grid, it was Ferrari, Mercedes, and now Red Bull recently, spending all the money, making all the money, mm-hmm. and they were the only ones that could compete. Now, we've still seen dominant teams dominating the track recently. But as these cost controls permeate further through the grid and we get further away from the original hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of R&D spending that went on, but before the cost controls went in, that certainly gave the bigger clubs an advantage right off the bat because they spent all this money over all these years. As that gap shrinks in terms of people spending money recently on R&D, you're seeing a hope that those teams that have traditionally been stuck at the bottom of the grid can have more success. You know, maybe not compete for titles, but the, you know, make the podium each year. But, and then again, it changed from a sport where you had no chance to compete unless you were willing to lose $150 million a year or what, pick a number, to now people look at it and be like, wait, I can make money and own a sports team, which again, those two things have not necessarily coexisted, not just have one, but I mean, across all sports. For, you know, you've had National Hockey League teams losing money, Major League Baseball teams losing money. Look around the global soccer ecosystem. Most MLS clubs lose money, but it's not just MLS. I mean, 75% of Premier League clubs lose money every single year. So, and that's the top soccer league in the world by a lot. But it's just with the Premier League does not have cost controls that have real teeth to them. So teams spend to lose money because they're chasing titles or keeping up to try to not get relegated down to the second division, down to the championship. So the cost controls, absolute game changer. It led to private equity firms now looking at these as viable assets to put their money and not get hit with a giant capital call every year because the race team's losing $100 million. And just, you know, Liberty has done a fantastic job in terms of monetizing this sport, creating revenue and not dinging the brand, which sometimes happens when you try to reach a larger audience. But those ultra premium brands still want to be part of this sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are all great points. And on the cost cap, I totally agree that it's been a game changer when you think about it from an investment perspective. But I think one thing that's interesting about that, as opposed to maybe other leagues in the US, like the NFL, the NBA, et cetera, marketing and driver salaries are excluded from that cost cap, which is a very different dynamic. Is there a world in which it would ever make economic sense for F1 to impose a salary cap for drivers? Or do you think this is working for them for now?
It's working for now. You know, it we'll see. And you know, so much of, you know, probably better than, you certainly know better than most. The car is the driver here, so to speak. I mean, driver.
That's very fair.
It's really on the edges in terms of the impact that the driver is having. So is there going to be a bidding war because there is some driver that comes out of nowhere that is, you know, suddenly a second faster on every lap than everybody else because their driving skills are that good? Yeah, maybe. And maybe they're maybe it's worth it. But you know, you have two guys at this point who are been paid dramatically more than everybody else with Lewis Hamilton and Verstappen, both, you know, many, many time world titleists each. And have had a lot of success. Lewis Hamilton also comes with a certain celebrity vibe that, you know, that
the star power is unmatched.
Star power is way beyond anybody else, any other driver out there, and arguably in a long time in F1. So there's something to be said for that as well. So I don't think F1 has to go that far. And this was kind of a palpable way to push through the cost caps and get the Ferraris and the Mercedes on, you know, they still want some advantages and, you know, this is one way to get at it. But listen, every sports league or series or whatever, you know, they want to maximize profitability as much as they can. So this is a little different because you don't have a union pushing back like you have in the team sports leagues in the United States, where they're negotiating against a league and trying to extract every possible, you know, bigger chunk of revenue from the particular league, and the league's trying to keep every possible dollar that they can for their owners. So I think the current format makes a lot of sense. Again, if you exclude those two guys, the delta between the lowest paid driver and the top paid driver, you know, or I shouldn't say top paid, maybe the third highest paid driver in the sport is not that crazy different. So,
yeah.
And again, as you have success, your paycheck goes up. And you've gotten to the point where, again, if you take out Verstappen and Lewis, Haas or anybody can afford, you know, the third, fourth, fifth highest paid driver, arguably. Yeah. I mean, you know, Haas might lose a little more money if they tried to sign one of those guys. And but again, hard to sign the third or fourth best driver if your car is not competitive. They have to be realistic in terms of the teams that those guys would ever consider joining as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting if the cost cap actually does tighten the playing field at all. I think hope springs eternal, but we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for years, the top teams have been figuring out a way to just be better. And so to your point, are they going to pour it all into somehow this driver mark, you know, stuff outside of the cap? It's an arms race always. And so if you can figure out a way to spend money to give you, because the margin is so small that if you can figure out that 1%, it's huge.
So
the big teams are, and the smaller teams, they're going to keep trying. They're going to, you know, figure out every sort of angle. So, I don't know if, you know, spending more marketing on driving, I mean, and that's kind of why those two things were kind of, they were carved out, one because you had existing drivers with massive salaries that was going to be untenable if they had to fall under the cap. But also you kind of just throw in the big guys a bone. And those were two categories that spending a lot of money in those two areas can help their business. But you could argue it doesn't necessarily help them on the track so much.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I want to go back to this idea of F1 as its own race promoter. I mean, all of F1's races are put on by local promoters except the Las Vegas Grand Prix, as you noted. And I think investors have liked this race promoter fee dynamic because you have these sort of long-term contracts where fees are locked in. There's an escalator, you know, throughout many years. And so it's predictable revenue. And I think if you look at the analyst research reports, there's a lot of eyes now on the Las Vegas Grand Prix in terms of the attendance, the economics, what it's bringing to F1. And this past year, attendance was down. It's the second year. It's not the first. I'm sure there were many reasons for that. But that was maybe potentially counterbalanced by increase in sponsorship revenue and other things. But what do you think about the model of F1 as its own promoter? And is it in F1's best interest to take that role on for more races, or do you think that Vegas is special in some way?
I think Vegas is special. I don't think F1 wants to be in the necessarily heavy CapEx business, because to your point, the current model is great.
Yeah. Just
give us a big license. It all drops to the bottom line, basically. And we can focus on selling sponsorships, selling media, and making our money there and then distributing what we do to the teams. And so I think this gives them a race and a weekend and a location to try things. And so, again, do they do this in another city? Sure, maybe two out of 24. How many races are we up to this year?
24 this year.
24. Okay. So could there be 2 out of 24 going forward? Sure. And they'll have to gauge, you know, you have to gauge what the demand is. Right now, the demand is pretty big to bring this series to your city. And so they're able to command, increases in the current license fee. If they decide that, you know, there isn't necessarily a sensational demand anymore and we can build a better business by doing all this ourselves, maybe. But again, we saw with Las Vegas, I mean, particularly starting from scratch, I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's a hard, things are going to go wrong. and it's, you're going to get attacked for it. and so I think, you know, again, I don't, who knows what's inside of Liberty Media's head right now, but I, you know, from what I understand, this works great for them. Have this one.
Yeah.
It's a trial. We'll do it for a few years. If for some reason we decide, holy cow, this is the future, we'll do another one, you know, but again, it's, you got to get it right, you know, because all eyes are on you in sports. So you can't rush these things, and you have to find the right location, and Vegas is kind of, you know, arguably a perfect location to do it, and for the F1 brand. So my guess is they, you know, they stick with the current model, I would assume.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's been fun to watch Vegas as sort of an incubator, in a sense, for them for different ideas, especially as they try to go a little bit more direct to fan. Like, they've been selling their own merch at Vegas because they can. And they, I think, trialed an LVMH proof of concept in 2023, and now it's rolling out to the entire sport, like, globally. And so I think it's been fun to see how they've used Vegas as a little bit as a test ground for other things that they want to do going forward. And it's a great marketing tool, to your point. But yeah, it's hard to argue the incredibly reliable revenue streams from these race promoter contracts, because it's, yeah, there's nothing really like it.
Could your daily routine be full of hormone disruptors? There are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our environment right now, in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare, and they all mess with our hormones. To combat this, we've been loving Hormone Harmony from Happy Mammoth, which contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors. With over 30,000 reviews and counting, a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code PADDOCKPROJECT at checkout. That's happymammoth.com, and use the code PADDOCKPROJECT for 15% off today.
So F1 makes money in several ways. We've talked about some of it, the race promoter fees, but it also gets a lot of money from media rights, from sponsorship deals. Do you see any of those three revenue streams as particularly compelling when it comes to future growth?
Great question. I think they all have upside, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. What is great about F1 is, of course, because it's a global property, so every market is interested. So if you have, if, you know, the German market, you know, has a downturn, and, you know, maybe our next rights fee in Germany might be off because the market's tough, but holy cow, the US economy is booming. Now, I know we live in a somewhat largely integrated world, where economies move together. But different markets are performing very differently at any different time, and media companies are performing in very different ways at any given time. So, you know, if you think about the NFL, which is the, you know, top dog in terms of media, but it all comes from the United States. I mean, the media revenue outside the United States, very, very small. The NBA is in a much better place in terms of being able to monetize its product outside the US from a media standpoint, because it's played in, basketball is played in every single country in the world, and the NBA's fan base runs through every single country in the world, basically. So I think media from that sense is well protected. And sponsorship, again, if the economy goes south globally, we have a global recession, one of the first things that gets cut is to sponsor marketing budgets. So I mean, that is always a risk, because it's an easy line item to cut back on. You don't necessarily want to start firing people right off the bat, but you can trim your marketing spend and media spend very easily. Now, big properties that have a lot of pricing ability and can pick and choose from sponsorships, so that's why they want to lock in long-term deals as much as possible, because much like the race fees, it sets you up with contractually obligated income. that is great. And if you're a public company, Wall Street really likes that. They like
Wall
that.
Wall Street loves that.
They love that that revenue certainty being locked in. And so there's no surprises from that standpoint. So I, you know, all three super important for the league or for the series. And I would argue all three still have upside. But they're all three have potential risks too. No different than most businesses. But the sports business, it's funny. We talk about this, a bit or a lot. I mean, less so now, but a few years ago, a lot, in terms of these businesses are, they're traditionally all thought of kind of as live sport businesses. You know, it's people showing up to watch sports. And during COVID, when people could not show up and watch it, people thought, oh my gosh, it's the end. All these properties are, they're screwed. Like, now, again, you didn't have the people that showed up. They couldn't come, you know, for a while, or they had to go to reduce capacity at these different places. But people tuned in like crazy to all these events, because sports is one of those properties that people just don't want to do without. And then as soon as people could start showing back up at things, they came back bigger than ever. People just said, oh my gosh, I can't believe miss live events for a year or 2 years, or depending where you are, you know. And the attendance at most sporting events has just been off the charts. Teams are getting better, leagues are getting better, race series are getting better in terms of how they use data and how they tap a fan on his shoulder or her shoulder saying, we got a race coming up in your area, or, you know, you want to buy this jersey, or, you know, the Fanatics model of just data, data, data. And we're just going to cultivate all this data we have to just monetize our fans. But they still have so much room. I mean, these leagues and teams have so much more runway in terms of monetizing their fan base. You know, it's the tech model of Amazon, Apple, Google. It's just, we're just going to hit you from every angle, and you don't even realize that we're making money off of you right now, but we are.
But so that's one thing I'm curious about, because if I were sitting at a league in their corporate office, I feel like I would be worried about the way that fan behavior is changing when it comes to watching sports. I think live events probably are doing better than ever, but people are not necessarily sitting down to watch 2 hour live games or live races at home. Like, they're on social media, they're watching highlights, they're following their favorite athletes on social media. How, as a league, do you monetize that value? Because I feel like I would be existentially worried that social media companies are kind of capturing the attention of these fans in a way that's undermining my big media rights deals with ESPN or Fox or whatever it may be. Like, how do leagues kind of stop the bleeding of the social media phenomenon?
It's a great question. And they're all, I mean, it's all front of mind for all of them right now. And having two teenage boys and watching how they consume sports, like, they'll sit down and watch an NFL game. And they're both big Yankee fans, so they'll watch like a whole Yankee game. But otherwise, it's just consuming snippets on TikTok, YouTube, whatever. Yeah. It's just snippets of things. Lots of highlights. So there's a few things going on here, and it's very. We talked about the NBA before, and people look at the NBA and they think, people don't watch necessarily a lot of NBA games live start to finish, but it is a very digestible content in short form. Yeah. Highlight here, highlight there. So you can monetize that through sponsorships and just in terms of who has access to those rights, because and you're not supposed to just pull them and throw them on Twitter. I mean,
but so many people do.
And the NBA. Yeah. And all these leagues are walking such a fine line, because they want the engagement and the conversation, and you don't want to be going after people for violating copyright. But you also have to look at it reasonably, you know, high content, you know, with, you know, if it's Bleacher Report or Turner Sports or whoever it is, you know, that those people, you have to be like, yeah, no, you can't do that. You know, they're not coming after me if I just pull a clip from somewhere and share it around. but so there is a way to value that. And that's what the NBA also, the NBA has a time problem in terms of people watching their games when you look at Europe or Asia, because they're all at night. So that does not translate to Europe or Asia at all. But so how they want to monetize it though, is this kind of short form, version of it. And so it's no, you know, F1's recognizing the attention span, people running shorter races. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Or they'll do the F1, they'll package it as the F1 race in 30 or whatever it may be, but they're owning that content.
Yeah. You have to find new ways to deliver, you know, it's, you know, the phrase go, you know, fish where the fishes are. That's it. That's why, you know, do deals with YouTube and then do deals with TikTok.
Yeah.
We need to take our content to where the people are consuming content. It's not on NBC. Everything's not on NBC, CBS, Fox, and ABC anymore. That's, you know, we moved to cable and people were digesting it then. And now this is just the next iteration of how people are going to take in content. And so the value though is because so few people, because you do still have people watching live, those rights are so valuable from a sponsorship standpoint and advertiser standpoint, because literally it's the only place you can get somebody to watch a commercial.
Yeah, it's true.
And so that still makes the, even though that live game audience might be down, again, forgetting the NFL, because it doesn't go down in the NFL, but everywhere else down dramatically, because you get, the reality is you just have many fewer people that can watch, because there's half as many people that have cable or access to linear television. So naturally ratings are going to go down by that much. But it is still extremely valuable for sponsors.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting conversation right now in the F1 world, because ESPN's deal in the US is up this year and they're negotiating now. And so I wonder, I mean, I think streaming platforms will definitely have a seat at the table in terms of the negotiations, whether that's Netflix, Amazon, Apple, et cetera. How do you see F1's media rights landscape evolving? I mean, they're aware, I'm sure, of this live trend going down, but at the same time, to your point, it's incredibly valuable. F1 has traditionally been pretty conservative when it comes to broadcasting and media rights. So I don't know if I expect a big change in the way that happens over the next couple of years, but there are certainly upsides to partnering with these streaming platforms. So how do you think F1 is thinking about that decision?
I would just echo what you said. They are no doubt talking to streamers and have to be a little leery of leaving ESPN, because I think ESPN has been a very valuable partner. Now, ratings after this massive uptick have been relatively flat over the last few years, but flat's kind of good right now. When you think about cable, linear TV. And so what we have seen, whether, you know, most recently with the NBA last year, people are going down both paths. They want to stick with the ESPNs of the world, but they also want to do a deal with Netflix or Amazon. Because if you look at just the raw numbers, number of people that have a Netflix, you know, Netflix just hit 300 million people. ESPN does not reach 300 million people.
Now, ESPN's audience is probably much more concentrated in terms of who F1 is looking for, but you can't argue the scale of Netflix.
and same with Amazon Prime. Now that you already have a subscription to Amazon Prime, and I can tune in and watch Thursday Night Football now. Now MLS, which we're working on our MLS valuations right now, they're you know, they were one of the original, and probably the first, they were the first big league really to go full time streaming only, which were 98% streaming only outside of a handful of their games. But, and theirs with Apple TV, of course. And, you know, but it's a different animal where you then, you need a subscription to access the MLS games. So it's not, oh, I, you know, I have Apple TV. Great. I can watch MLS now. No, no. You know, again, you get a few games, but if you really want to watch MLS, then you need an MLS subscription to access it. So that, that is a challenge that MLS is dealing with right now. But I would think with F1, there's we'll certainly have conversations with both. And in terms of maximizing your scale and your audience, there's got to be a way to do a deal with both of them. I mean,
yeah. I mean, we've talked about Vegas as a test ground. They own that race. They should do a live partnership with Netflix or Amazon or Apple or something for that race and test it out.
They should, they got to do something, you know. Now NASCAR for a long time has split their rights, you know, between, it's varied, but you know, for Fox and NBC for a long time. And so that, you know, they have to figure out what the model works, because you want people to be able to find, not have to worry.
Yeah.
Like, oh, is this game, is this race Amazon or is this ESPN? You need some level of consistency. So whether it's splitting the calendar or all my, you know, as we've seen with the NFL, all the games are going to be, all the races are going to be on ESPN, and we're going to have two races, you know, whatever, on Amazon. And that's how this cycle of contracts go. And you see how it works. Amazon, I mean, listen, Amazon is going all in. I mean, they've done the NFL, they've done NBC, they're adding soccer, they've done soccer. Like, they have aggressively leaned into sports. Netflix, not so much, but they're doing, so Netflix makes sense because they're doing one-off football game. They have not committed to the full-on, we want regular sports programming. They want boxing match, you know, the one-off programming that's going to get people to sign up.
But what's good about what Netflix did with Christmas Game Day is they proved to the NFL that they can do it and that they can handle that scale. So I think that in and of itself is a great
it's
takeaway.
It's huge. Yeah, no, it's absolutely. At this point, Apple, I think, you know, certainly when MLS signed their Apple deal, a lot of people thought Apple would have leaned in much harder into sports and created a full-on brand of just a whole ecosystem of sports content on Apple TV, but they haven't as much as they want. But Netflix and Amazon are both taking different paths, but both are committed to sports properties.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Netflix, it's hard to have a conversation about F1 growth and not talk about Drive to Survive. I know you mentioned it's not just Drive to Survive and there are other things, whether that's the cost cap or whatnot. But do you feel like the impact of Drive to Survive is overblown? Is it justified? And how does F1 ensure that the fans that it's brought in through that show are here for the long term and turn into motorsport race watchers rather than just kind of in and around the periphery of the culture of the sport?
Yeah, I think it is overblown and I think it is justified. I think it's both. I think both answers are right. And I don't think you need to convert every Drive to Survive person into a hardcore race fan. You know, I think, and the way sports are set up now, it's okay to just bring in them as casual participants in F1. You know, they don't need to be, you know, watching every single Sunday morning and go, you know, I'm going to three races this year, whatever, which would be expensive. But I think they can, it helps with both. You know, I mean, one of my closest friends, he watches every single race. I was like, really? Suburban New
Jersey. There are only 24 of them.
So, I get that. But like, he's a suburban 50-something-year-old guy and never watched a race before Drive to Survive. And he's now all in. Went to Miami last year. I mean, like, he's all in.
I started watching Drive to Survive in 2020, probably, and I couldn't have told you the difference between NASCAR and F1 before I pressed episode one of that show. And now I've dedicated every waking minute of my free time to this sport and talk about every single race. And yeah, I mean, it's had a magical, it's had a magical effect on me in my life, but I recognize that, you know, it does, that doesn't need to be everyone. They don't necessarily need to be watching every single race, but what I do think doesn't get enough credit is a lot of people say, oh, the Drive to Survive fans that came into the sport aren't interested in the racing. They're not interested in any of the technology or engineering. Like, I think that's a fallacy. I think a lot of people found it to be a gateway to the sport. And of course, you have people who are not going to sit down and watch a race and care more about the personalities and the drama. But I think it would be a mistake to categorize the Drive to Survive era of fans as people who only want one thing or only care about one thing.
I couldn't agree more. And I think gateway is a great way. I mean, everybody needs a gateway into a sport. Nobody just all of a sudden is a diehard fanatic and knows everything about a sport. I mean, that's not the way it goes. It's, you know, you need an introduction into a sport. And for a lot of people, Drive to Survive was certainly it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's a great note to end on. Kurt, thank you so much for the conversation. This was incredible for me. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I had fun.